chapter 11, 50, verse 56, Christ is talking to some of the disciples, and he tells them, first he calls them hypocrites like he does from time to time, and he tells them, you can look outside, you can see the weather, you can see what's going on, but you can't discern the times that we live in. And he tells them, you know, I am the Son of God. I'm standing here in front of you. This is one of the most momentous times in the history of all mankind, and what will be mankind until the second coming, and you don't even know what's going on right in front of you. You can't discern the world around you for what's important. And he was basically telling them they didn't understand what's going on in their life. Now, I don't have a polling station in my house. I don't have the ability, like politicians do, to start calling various members of the Church of God or the greater community and see what's important to them in their religious life. What I do have is a rather recent invention called Facebook. Now, if you happen to be an individual who's friends with me on Facebook, it's not something I use very often. I probably look at it once a quarter, post maybe once every 3 years. I mainly just want to see if Scott Moss is trying out some new material to sleep in his backyard and work on new camping stuff. That's not what I like. So I don't get on very often. It's not something I've really been a big fan of, and I'll be honest, it's the first time I've ever gotten a message derived from stuff I saw on Facebook, but bear with me today, because while I don't have a polling station, something over the holidays here where we had some time off from work and we were spending some time with family, I was able to look on there and kind of see what people was really driving, what are people thinking about. Because if they're taking the time to post something on Facebook, I figured, they're probably then at least it's something in their life. Because that's what I do. The one thing I do like about Facebook, I like to see what other people are reading. Because people will post something that's important to them, articles that they're looking at. That's what I like most, not pictures of food and things like that. But I like to see what other people are thinking about. And based on my very unscientific polling of the past 4 to 6 weeks, what seems to be the most important things in people's lives seems to be aspects of Obamacare and healthcare, which I'll be honest is important to me. It affects everything with my day-to-day life and practice that I have. Duck Dynasty and Phil Robertson's choice of words in dealing with social issues and some of those other social issues that he raised. And the last one is being rumors of wars in the Middle East and beyond. There's lots of hot spots in the world, and it seems to get people wondering and aggravated from some time to time. And I realize that these are some of the things that people are important enough that they feel the need to post about it or cite articles about some of these subjects, then it must be some things that are leading to some angst among people. Especially, honestly, in the greater Church of God community. This is something that seems to be bothering. So what I'd like to look at today, and I would like to ask the question, is what is a Christian to make of the world that we live in? What is a true Christian to make of the world that we live in, especially in light of some uncertain times that we live in, and if we discern the times that we live in now? Because Christ used those words talking to those individuals, but that question is a question that comes down to everybody. Are you discerning the times that you live in and recognizing what you need to do? As a Christian, how should I be living my life? I'd like to take a look at the world we live in today, kind of a snapshot view of some current events, mainly from two different aspects. And honestly, this was driven, as I said, from seeing what other people seem to be thinking about and kind of addressing it. So I'd like to look at the world from two standpoints, one from a global political scene, and the second from a social cultural scene as well, and ask that same question of what are we as a Christian to make of the world that we live in. So let's start from a global political scene. Let's start on the bigger level. About 3 weeks ago, we were down in Cincinnati having lunch with my parents, Sunday afternoon, having brunch at Cracker Barrel, dining on biscuits and apple butter, which is nothing better in the world than sitting at a Cracker Barrel, having biscuits and apple butter. That's one of my favorite things in the world to do. And we were having your normal conversation you'd have on a Sunday afternoon amongst family, socio-political activities that was going on in the world in 1914 leading up to World War I and how that was affecting, you know, the greater European boundaries. You know, the stuff most people talk about on a Sunday morning. Actually, my son, we were driving up today, he was reading a book and he was asking me about World War I versus World War II because he was reading something about, because his book had the same thing that a lot of people have noticed is this is 2014. 1914 was the year World War I started. The events kind of July leading up to it start in August 1st, in the middle of August. This has been 100 years since the start of the First World War, which in all intents and purposes drastically changed the world we live in. We are still dealing with ramifications, both nationally as well as globally, that took place because of the ramifications of that war. Boundaries that were drawn, sectarian violence has existed because of it. Our world was shaped by 1914 to 1919, that 5 years of a war that changed the world. And we're still dealing with it, and now this year you're going to be seeing more and more on it because we're coming into the 100-year anniversary. And many people have started to even begin noticing. I had started studying on it a few weeks ago, and it's kind of a love of mine. I've always had a bit of an affinity for World War One. And this is what drove our conversation when I was talking to my father, because he was doing some studying on it as well for an article he was writing, and we started getting into some conversations that kind of led to this subject. And what I eventually found, that I was looking at this about 6 weeks ago, was an essay that was written for the Brookings Institute, which is a liberal think tank in Washington, D.C., but it's a very interesting essay written by Margaret McMillan, who's an author of international studies and a professor at Oxford University in England. And she wrote a very lengthy essay that's been since condensed and published by a lot of different articles. The Guardian did one, I think Washington Post did one as well, where she cites five characteristics that exist in the world today that are very similar to what was going on in 1914 and some of the years leading up to World War One, and how, honestly, our world is not much different now as it was then. And the global calamity that existed at the time then, leading to even worse, could take place as well. And it was a very interesting read, and I began seeing other people begin to link to this article, and so it made me realize kind of what's going on now could lead to various things as then as well. So I'll quickly summarize what she notes are some of these five similarities. She noted in 1914 you had a fading empire. You know, Great Britain and the British Kingdom was the power of the day. The sun didn't set on the British Empire around the world, but this was the end, kind of leading into the waning of their society, and at least from their dominance standpoint. Today we have us. Since 1990, in the fall of the Berlin Wall and the USSR kind of coming to a close, the United States has been the sole superpower. But, as we've all noted many times before, our power seems to be kind of waning as well. It seems to be in the twilight years as other nations begin to rise more power, deafening to take over our society. Because that's the second thing she notes, that if you're going to have one superpower waning, you must have another one rising. In 1914, it was Germany. At that time, only a nation for about 50 years really was beginning to realize they wanted a larger piece of the pie. They wanted to be on the world scene more. They began building a navy to rival Britain. This day we have China, recognizing their independence and their dominance in Southeast Asia, as well as the Asian continent, realizing they have more and more power, more and more means to do so from a population standpoint, as well as from a resource standpoint, and exerting control, or at least influence in other areas, South China Sea, Taiwan, some aspects of South Korea, as well as Japan in their region, beginning to exert more of an influence in their sphere. The third thing she noted was the idea of global flashpoint. She has a great quote where she said, "Today we call it terrorism. Then we called it anarchy." You know, now we talk about terrorism all often. You know, what was going on with the Arab Spring over the past couple of years, the events in Syria and terrorist activities in the Middle East and even up and through Europe. They had the same problems back in the 1915, 1916, kind of during that time as well. They called it anarchy then. You know, at the time in the pre-World War I world, all the nations were ruled by empires. People were wanting to rise up or ruled by kingdoms, you know, kings and queens and whatnot, monarchies. And they wanted to rise up. They called it anarchy at the time. They wanted rule of the people. You know, the Tsarist Russia had their issues with their revolution in about 1914. Austro-Hungary had theirs. Prussia in Germany had all of theirs. By the end of World War I, only one monarchy would still exist in the world, that being Great Britain's, which, as we all know, is more of a figurehead than anything. The prime minister rules and parliament rules their world and their sphere for themselves. So then they called it anarchy, as all this was taking place in little hotspots here and there. Today we just call it terrorism. We have a different name for it, but it's the same process. The fourth thing she noted was the idea of globalization. We don't often think about it, but in pre-World War I world, that was the first true expense of globalization taking over the world. You could get products from all over the world bringing in, which is bringing in trade from different parts of the world, getting exposed to different cultures. Very similar to the world we live in now. It also really got interrupted by World War I and World War II, and then really didn't begin to pick up until the end of the 20th century to the same level that existed in World War I, you know, world throughout Europe and Asia as well. And the fifth thing she noted was the aspect of an arms race. I mentioned Germany wanting to rise up with their power, build a bigger navy to take on Britain's, and this led to other nations needing to build up because they felt they were being, you know, their protection would be dependent on it. Today we have the same idea of nuclear proliferation. We live in the 20th century with two major powers keeping each other at bay. But we've seen over the years more and more, India, Pakistan, Israel, Iran trying to, you know, forming more and more countries getting nuclear weapons with the potential for devastation, as one nuclear weapon can wipe out an advantage that any other nation has in the blink of an eye. not to mention even global terrorism that can take place from a cyber standpoint. We like many areas where I've lost power this past week for a day or two. Our society shuts down. You did not have power grid out. How long would it take for our society to begin to backslide so quickly? And all that, this is where the idea of an arms race is not always just conventional warfare. So all these things were present then, present now. She makes a very compelling case. It's a very lengthy essay. I highly recommend the piece by Margaret McMillan. It makes you a little bit sad, and that's what it comes down to, because when you really look at it, it seems scary to think of what the world was then and what the world really is now and the brink of conflict that could be current. The potential is there. We don't know if it will be the case. But looking at the sheer size of what happened in World War I and the trouble that went through it and the ramifications of it, and to think that something of that same scope that this author is talking about here could occur once again can be scary. It makes you think. So my previous question once again is true. What is a Christian to make of the world that we live in? I bought this Bible 14 years ago, right before my wife and I got married, right before we went off to the Ambassador Bible Center. And one of the first things I did is I wrote a quote on the inside cover that's been there ever since. It's right here. I had my wife write it so I could still read it all these years later. My handwriting's terrible. The quote says this. It's by John Page, who is a philosopher. He says, "We know the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. Do you not think an angel rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm? We know the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. Do you not think an angel rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm?" I wrote it then at that time. George W. Bush quoted it as his first inauguration in 2000. I thought it was a very interesting quote at the time. 9 months later, obviously, 9/11 would happen, and it made me start thinking about it even more then. There is an angel that rides in the storm, and sometimes we think we have control over everything, but we have to realize that events happen because there is a greater power. And things don't happen unless he has control over it. What got me thinking about this topic really originally, not necessarily was Facebook, although that kind of drove it a little bit, but I told you I was doing a little bit of study on World War I just from my own personal standpoint, and I came across the story of a gentleman named Gavrilo Princip. Has anybody ever heard of Gavrilo Princip? Here you might. He was probably one of the most, performed one of the most important events that happened in the 20th century. Gavrilo Princip was a 20-year-old Serbian national in the city of Sarajevo, and on July of 1914, he pulled a gun, and he killed the Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife, the Crown Duchess, assassinating them, if you will. Once again, we called it anarchy back then, as Mark Millen says, setting off a chain of events that started World War I. You've all heard of Archduke Franz Ferdinand being killed in Sarajevo. We don't always hear the story of Gavrilo Princip, the 20-year-old who really set all that motion and all the events in motion. It's an interesting story I'd like to share with you, because Gavrilo Princip was one of seven individuals that day who was intent to try to kill the Archduke. The Archduke was coming down. He was the crown prince of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Serbian nationals and whatnot in Sarajevo really did not like their being controlled by them, and they knew he was coming, and they put this motion in plan for months, planning on wanting to the assassination. And so Gavrilo Princip was one of seven individuals. So that day, the route that the Archduke was taking was planned out ahead of time, and everybody knew where he was going. So they all stationed themselves along the corridor. And as he began driving, he came past the first individual who decided not to act at all. He chickened out, put his gun away, and ran away. The second individual in line did not chicken out. He had a bomb, and the motorcade was driving by. He ran out, threw his bomb at the car. Now, it only had a 10-second fuse, though, and the driver saw the bomb coming, sped away really quick, and drove really fast. However, three cars back was another car carrying some other luminaries, which did explode, injuring some of the individuals in the car. Now, chaos ensues. People rush in, police come in, seal down the area, and the other five individuals realized it's up. We've been planning for months, and it failed. And they're sad. They disperse, not wanting to get captured. And Gavrilo Princip goes to a little cafe up the road, orders some food, and he's drowning in sorrow sitting there in a cafe. Now, the Archduke was a pretty good individual. He was actually a nice man who really cared about the people in that area despite the fact they were trying to kill him. And so what he wanted to do is he wanted to drive to the hospital because there were individuals in his motorcade who were hurt. So he tells his driver, "Let's go to the hospital. I want to go see them and visit with them." He doesn't have the same retinue of soldiers with him at this point. They begin driving. They get a little lost. They stop. The car backs up and it stalls. They're pulling up their map, trying to figure out what to do. And where the car happened to stall was right in front of this little cafe. Gabriel Princip was sitting, eating his dinner, worrying about how their plot didn't happen. And he looks up, and he looks out the window, and sees his car just sitting there, and nobody's even paying attention, and it's just right there. It's a open car. So he pulls his gun, starts walking. He's within 5 feet before anyone even sees him come. Pulls his gun, shoots the Archduke and his wife, killing them, thus starting the spark that would lead to global war and conflict. When I heard that story, we were really kind of looking through all of it, I thought about that quote. Is there not an angel that rides in the storm and directs the course of action? Let's turn to Daniel chapter 4. Because as we know, World War I had to happen. It changed the world, and it's something from God's prophetic standpoint had to occur. The changing of the monarchies, the resetting of the world stage, is basically a rise of a reinvention of the Roman Empire to a degree in the Germanic states. It was something that we read about Daniel had to occur. Daniel chapter 4 tells us that events of this magnitude do not happen by mere happenstance. Daniel 4, verse 17, the right page, says, "This decision is by the decree of the watchers and the sentence of the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whoever he will, and sets over it the lowest of the men." That last sentence really is the SBS statement, if you will, of the entire book of Daniel. The Lord, the Most High, rules in the kingdom of men. The book of Daniel is about the setting of rulers and the taking down of empires and the establishing of them. It's a grand history of mankind, from the Greek Empire to the Roman to everything coming down from Babylon to the end time. And in all of that, that sentence there reigns supreme. The Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives to it whomever he will. Events do not occur happenstance. An angel rides in that storm and directs the cause. And that's what basically Daniel's telling us here. So when we think about recent political leaders, whether we agree with them or not, they're there for a purpose. We might not always agree with their actions, we might not always agree with their activities, but there's a purpose to it. And we might not always understand what that is as well. And we sometimes want to get involved and make our peace and make our point, but Most High rules in the kingdom of God. And is established there for a cause. And events, much like Gabriel Princip's story, don't occur. We call it fate, you know, in the world we say it's fate, but that action had to happen. And an angel that day was directing and making sure that the conclusion that was prescribed from that point had to occur. Let's look over to 1 Kings chapter 22 and continue this point a little bit, kind of look at a few scriptures here. 1 Kings 22, God's and the angelic determination in the world and how things occur and their plan. 1 Kings 22 is a very interesting set of scriptures. We'll read a fair amount of this chapter. As we see here, the divided kingdom of Israel and Judah. We have King Jehoshaphat, who's king over Judah, as well as King Ahab, who was a fairly unrighteous king ruling over Israel at the time. Let's pick it up in verse 4. Because they realize they want to get together to go take over the land of Ramoth Gilead. They're kind of come together. Ahab's proposing the two come together. They can go take over this land together. Verse 4 says, "So he said to Jehoshaphat," he's being Ahab, "will you go with me and fight in Ramoth Gilead?" Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, "I am as you are, my people are your people, my forces are your forces." Also Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, "Please inquire of the word of the Lord this day." The king of Israel gathered all his prophets, and these are the lowercase p, these are his people that he surrounds himself with, together 400 men, and said to them, "Shall I go against Ramoth Gilead to fight, or shall I refrain?" So they said, "Go up, for the Lord will deliver it into your hand, king. You're going to be great." And Jehoshaphat said, "Is there still not a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of him?" Jehoshaphat was still a righteous king. He wants to know if actually God's going to be on our side. So the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "There's still one man, Micaiah, the son of Imlah, by whom we may inquire of the Lord, but I hate him, because he does not prophesy good concerning me, but evil." And Jehoshaphat said, "Let the king say such things. I don't like this guy. He never says things that I like to hear. I like these 400. They tell me exactly what I want to hear. I want to keep them around." We can drop down then to verse 17. So they go and find Micaiah. They bring him forward and they ask him a question. And verse 17 is Micaiah's response, inspired by God. It says, "Then I said, I saw all of Israel scattered on the mountains, and the sheep have no shepherd. And the Lord said, there have no master, and let them return to the house in peace. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell you he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil? And Micaiah said, "Therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing by, and at his right hand and on his left." So we see here a scene very reminiscent of the early part of Job. We're transported to the throne room of God, and angels are coming and going and sitting before his court. And the Lord said, "Who will persuade Ahab to go up, that he may fall at Ramoth Gilead?" So one spoke in this manner, another spoke in this manner. Then a spirit came forward and said before the Lord, "I will persuade him." And the Lord said to him, "In what way?" So he said, "I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets." And the Lord said, "You shall persuade him and also prevail. Go and do so." So we see here an evil spirit, much like Satan coming before God and asking, "Can I go mess with Job?" And he says, "Yes, you may." He puts a hedge around to a degree. You can't do this, but you can't do this. He gives him permission to a level. They can only go with God's permission. This is an evil spirit saying, "I'll go lie to these 400 and tell them, convince them of everything." And he goes, "Yeah, go ahead, because this is what needs to happen." And so he allows him to go. In verse 22, it says, "The Lord said, oh, and we went through that." So we go down, we know what happens. Those 400 did so. Now the battle will take place, and Ahab will fall, just as it says. He'll go into battle, they will lose, the armies get routed, and Ahab dies. There's a great over in verse 28, Ahab here basically says, we already know he doesn't like Micaiah. So he says, "Go lock him up. He's been saying these bad things. I'll deal with you when I get back." And verse 28 is great. Basically, they're pulling away. He goes, "You're not going to come back. It's like, did you make it back at all? I just prophesied you're going to die." And we know that happens. So I like to imagine scenes like this, kind of almost like Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner, you see, he's being dragged off in chains. So I'll deal with you when you get back. And he gets a little one-liner right in the scene when you get back. I find that to be a very interesting scene. But we see here that an angel literally rode in the storm and directed the counsel of a king of Israel and projected the course of happening, because it had to happen as it was. This was an evil king that God decided to deal with this way. The story highlights that there's more in heaven and earth than we can see and that we can affect. The decisions made here by this ruler Ahab, as well as the outcome of the battle, were decided not by might, not by speed, but by God and by the angels that deemed the course to go. We should remember this unseen power that plays in the world. Let's turn over to 2 Kings 6, as we remember this unseen power, because in this case, God directs it in a way for a negative aspect, 1 Kings 6, verse 14. But it's also there for our protection, and this is how we should take comfort. 1 Kings 6, verse 14 is basically, we have the story here of Elisha, who's sitting in the city of Dothan, and the Syrian Empire had come down and wants to capture him because they know he's a powerful prophet and an advisor to the king, so that they find out who's in Dothan, so they send the army down to capture him. Elisha and his one servant. He doesn't have an army with him. And we have in verse 14, it says, "And they sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city. And when the servant of the Lord God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, 'Alas, my master, what shall we do?'" And this is that same question I asked before. What shall we as Christians in the modern day, how should we be? "So he answered, 'Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those are with them.' Elisha prayed, 'Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see.' And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots and fire all around Elisha." It's the unseen powers that are in control. It's that angel that rides in the storm, as that quote I look at, shows that's who was in control that day. Elisha was spared. That was what the true power of the day. These two individuals looked out their window and see an army surrounding the entire nation, and they were fearful. They were thinking in human terms of, "Oh, we're not strong enough. I don't have weapons. We don't have an army." But the army really was the powerful one that stood around, and Elisha prayed to God and showed him what really was the powerful aspect of that day. So what is a Christian to make of the world that we live in? When faced with daunting aspects of the world that can sometimes seem so overwhelming. If wars and battles are to take place, then the best thing we can do to be served is to make sure we're on the side of he who controls it. I can't stockpile enough weapons. I can't stockpile enough food. I can't make enough alliances. The only thing I can do is be on the side of he who controls it. He who directs the angels that rise in that storm. He who has an army that we may not be able to see, but is more powerful than anything that can be put on this earth in this time or forever. That That's what I come down to. It's a simple aspect, but sometimes it's one that needs reminding of us. That I'm best served not trying to control it by the world and the means that I do have control of, but maybe more on my knees, making sure I'm right with the one who does have control. The second thing I want to talk about was a global political sense. The other thing I want to talk about is the cultural social scene. This is the other thing that seemed to be driving people's Facebook timelines, and it's been something that's been on my mind for a while as well. Because while I have no control over the global scene, I don't have control over who's the president, who's making alliances in Europe, the UN, the Hague, or anywhere else. I've been to the Middle East once, and nobody asked my opinion on how we should solve the Middle East peace crisis. So be it. I don't have any control over that. What I do have control of my own life, that of my family, and the sphere which I live in, and I have control of what I let into that sphere. I can't control what's out there, but I can control what I let in, and what I hold on, and what I seek to be with my family. You know, we live in a world that has a lot of blessings, and accords us, members of the Church of God, a lot of freedoms. I drove for 2.5 hours today up from Indianapolis to Fort Wayne to come to church on a Saturday, which is not very similar to what many people do. Nobody's stopping. The police didn't pull me over and ask me why I was all dressed up. We got a sign out in the front. The Starbucks is getting a little weird, but that's all right. We have a sign out front saying, when we're here or whatnot, we don't have to hide. We were able to walk around in peace and worship, unlike many times in history, which was not allowed. And I think sometimes because of that, we've become a little complacent. Both with ourselves, but also with those that we choose as our heroes. Those who we choose to let into our life that we might hold up. My Facebook friends have loved over the past few months to hold up such luminaries as Phil Robertson, the patriarch member of the Duck Dynasty clan, who said the remarks he did. They love to hold up Megyn Kelly, or other Fox News hosts who love to go after liberals and yell at them. We love to hold up Glenn Beck, or some other quasi-religious social commentator or political talk show host. And we sometimes think we're on the same side. We're all fighting the same battle.
Yeah.
I'm with them. We're all looking at the same thing. We all agree wholeheartedly. We hold similar beliefs. When Megyn Kelly brings people on her shows and yells at liberals, I love it. Don't let them talk. Just keep yelling even louder. That's how you win a debate. If I can yell louder than you, then I'm right. We love it when Glenn Beck goes on his show and does the same thing. Or he even talks sometimes about aspects of British Israelism and the Lost Ten Tribes, and we think, this guy's preaching the gospel. He has the same beliefs we do. And we love it when Phil Robertson, with his big long beard and camo, goes on UN and gives an article in GQ magazine and talks about homosexuality and gay marriage. And we feel we've been beaten down years after years because we agree with his stance, and no one else seems to want to say it in the media. At least he took his pulpit and he did it. Good for him. But we should choose our heroes very carefully in this world, and we need to remember who we really are. And we also need to remember who they are as well. The day is going to come when these people are going to turn their eyes on us. They're going to see what we do. They're going to see what we say. They're going to see what we write, what we preach. And they're not necessarily going to see a lot of similarity. And we may think we're in agreement, but I don't think they're going to share that same thing. We might think they're sometimes preaching the gospel, but these people are not following God's way of life. And to be honest with you, they'll turn their ire on us just as quickly as they do on the people that we like to praise them up for now. And that same yelling and tactics will be used against us just as quick in the world when they start to notice us. Right now they don't. The day's coming when they will. Consider those same individuals and some of their beliefs and some of their actions. I cited Megyn Kelly because I found it very humorous. She got some hot water in December because she got into a debate with somebody basically saying that Santa Claus is white. And so she made a statement and got into a little bit of hot water. Well, he's not. He's not black either. I'll put it to rest today. Debating the cultural ethnicity of a make-believe character is not one way to kind of get into my social graces. But indeed, if you had to put one, I'll tell you who he is. I'm going to dispel the rumor today. He'd be Middle Eastern. Because Santa Claus is basically based on the former pagan god Moloch. And when God gave the land of Canaan to the Israelites and let them go into the land, he said, get rid of their idols, get rid of their gods, and kick them out. And Moloch was a god that people would bring and put their children on and sacrifice them to, hoping to get his undying love and whatever else. And that's made it. Now we just put our children on it. We don't, but individuals put their children on it and ask for presents. But this is what, you know, they were an example we've been done. So if anything, Santa Claus would be Middle Eastern. He wouldn't be white, black, or Russian, or anything else. That's what he would be. But he's neither. He's none of that. But look at how irate she got when somebody attacked her fake religious lowercase g god, and she had to defend an ethnicity of a make-believe character, and took that very defensively. Just talking about, you know, this is another person thinking he was real, just talking about what they think his ethnicity would be. How will he want to say, no, he's not real? You shouldn't keep him. You shouldn't keep Christmas. You should look at the Feast of Tabernacles. You should look at the Passover. You should look at God's holiday plan. She got really upset when someone just thought he wasn't right. How do you think she's going to respond when someone like that, you know, brings something like that up? Or Glenn Beck. I used to listen to Glenn Beck. I haven't in 2 years. From what I do remember in the times I did, this time of year he'd wear terrible Christmas, you know, Christmas gaudy sweaters and get sappy and talk about, you know, how wonderful a time, you know, the Christmas season would be. How's he going to respond when saying the same thing? No, that's not what you should be following. You should be following God's plan. He gave us holy days and holy times prescribed by him. Is he going to take that pretty kindly? He doesn't take it, he doesn't like it right now when cities take down nativity scenes and he rails and brings protests against people like that. How's that same ire going to be to individuals like us then? And then there's Phil Robertson. Now, I've watched Duck Dynasty from time to time. Who doesn't like rednecks with guns and money? It's an interesting time if you've ever seen the show. But if you actually read his article, and took the time not just to read the quotes, the GQ article that he gave is actually fairly lengthy. But if you look through his quotes, honestly, his words were pretty crude. They weren't speech seasoned with salt, as James says. They weren't indicative of when you read through the Gospels of how Christ, you know, talked to individuals who were sinners and how Christ talked about things. It was actually fairly crude. It was done for shock value, more than anything. And honestly, the ratings have never been better ever since he went through that process. I don't feel too bad for him. They're doing okay. Anyway, it wasn't how we would really talk about it. He may have been saying something in some way that's similar to how we believe, but he wasn't representing me. And he wasn't representing you by the same token. In 2 Timothy 3:1, let's turn there. Thinking about all these got me thinking about this scripture. 2 Timothy 3. Because Timothy talks about what it's going to be like in the end times, and what speech is going to be like, what people are going to be like, and what they're going to think, and how they're going to view people like us. 2 Timothy 3, starting at verse 1. It says, we know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. So we know there he's looking for. He's looking prophetically. This is what it's going to be like in the last days. It's going to be perilous. It's going to be a rough time. In the last days, it's not going to be good. Perilous times are stressful times. Stress brings out who people really are. It's easy to be nice and good to individuals when everything's going really well. When stressful times come, that's what brings out who a person really is. All these attributes we laud about people when they're doing it for things we agree with, if they're turned on us when stressful times come, we have to be very leery. So when we see verse 1, we know what the time frame here that he's talking about, these traits that he's going to list. Numerous traits are going to be present in the world and individuals are going to cause these perilous times to come on. Verse 3, we won't go through all of them. I want to just highlight a few. Verse 3 says they'll be unloving, unforgiving, slanderers without self-control, brutal, and despisers of good. One translation used for despisers of good says hate which is of God. Because we know what is good is basically of God. And these are people who despise good, so we're looking at people who hate what is of God. The church's message is a strong message. It's a message of repentance. It's a message of accepting what is wrong and putting it away, and repenting and coming into God's way of life and following it wholeheartedly. It's a message that when you start to examine it, does not look like the world's view of Christianity. But then in quotes to the degree, Christians will not like hearing what we have to say when perilous times come. Verse 5 goes on to talk about having a form of godliness, but denying its power, and from such people turn away. That same translation for, I like this one, it says a form of godliness. It says those who act religious. And that's basically what a form of godliness is. And it says denying its power. The power is the Holy Spirit. So these are people who act religious but lack God's Holy Spirit. Those who lack his way of life within them. This scripture is talking about people who, in the end times, when stressful times come upon them, will be the ones who are deemed religious at that time. These are the people who the world will look at and say, you evangelicals, if you will. People who are deemed to be the religious people of that time. And when the chips are down, they're going to turn just as quickly on us as they do on some of the liberals that we love now that we cheer for sometimes, don't we? That same iron will be turned against us. You know, ask the church, the true church of God, in the first, second, and third century, after Christ's death, when the church is beginning to grow, ask them what it was like, if you could, if you had time, machine. But go back and, you know, and look, ask them what it was like being in a nation that was becoming Christian. The Roman Empire, you know, by 325, when Constantine's in power, it had been going on for a while, was becoming a, quote, Christian nation, fully ratified then under Constantine's rule. It wasn't really a Christian nation, it was a pagan nation that he just slapped a phrase on. But ask the people who were trying to keep a true way of God's life, what it was like to be in a Christian nation when the perilous times came. They were labeled Jews, because you meet on Sabbath, because you keep those holy days. You're not one of us. They were made slaves. They were persecuted. They were cast out. They were killed. That's what it was like to be a true Christian when other nations were turning into, you know, Christian nations at the time, and perilous times came upon them. The heroes that we have to hold up from time to time, honestly, these ones I referenced here, I think have done more harm than good to the Greater Church of God community over the years. Because think about it. Think for a second, what was it like 5 years ago, 10 years ago in our world, from a political discourse? Could individuals disagree without hating each other? Could we disagree without becoming disagreeable? You know, from a political standpoint, people love to talk about in the 80s, where you had Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, who was the Democratic head of Speaker of the House. They didn't like each other, but they got along, they got things done. You can disagree and be on polar opposite sides of a political spectrum or social spectrum, but recognize and work together. The past 5 to 10 years, our world has become one of polarization, of fragmentation, of designating people we don't agree with as enemies, and yelling at them. If I shout louder, I'm better than you. It's become super pervasive in our talk radio scene. That's what the world's become. Now think about that same attitude, and tell me you didn't see those same things 3 years ago, when we in the Greater Church of God community had some of our own issues. Tell me you didn't see those same traits. We've let it into our own lives. We've held these heroes up for a long time, and they sometimes have been pervasive amongst us, and they've poisoned us sometimes, if we can be brutally honest. I've mentioned it before, I think, when I spoke. I used to be a talk radio junkie. I used to listen to it all the time when I worked out when I was younger. It would get me so riled up. Some people listen to hard music. I listen to talk radio. It just get me kind of riled up. But I started to recognize a few years ago, it was poisoning me. It was turning me angry. It was putting me in an attitude and a place that wasn't good. It was taking me a long time to try to turn away. I had to listen to it 3-4 years. And anytime I kind of see references to it, those same attitudes come back, and I recognize it in my life. Be very careful who you choose to hold up as a hero, and who you decide to let into your life to start influencing how you want to believe. Apply these principles of 2 Timothy 3. Look through them. See if any of these are very similar to people that we want to hold up as heroes, and do they match? Do they pass muster, if you will? An old-timey phrase, but you know, look at that. Is this what you see? And be very worried. Be very cautious who you hold up and who you let into your life, because they do have control and they will exert influence over you. In conclusion, we as Christians, what are we to make of the world that we live in? How do we respond to it? Two things. We need to make sure we're on the right side of the conflict. Make sure you're right with God. Only He has the control. We cannot physically prepare for it anyway. I cannot become swifter. I cannot become stronger. I cannot become mightier. But I have faith in that angel that rides in that storm and directs it. And I have faith in the God who has control over that angel and who has fully control over the storm. And the only thing I can do is make sure I'm right with him. And secondly, make sure that we're careful who we have and let to be influenced into our lives. Who we let in. Who we let walk through that door of our mind. Apply these principles of 2 Timothy 3. Look through them and see if any of them apply, and go the reverse way. Look through the true fruits of the Spirit. That's what it should be. People we let into our lives should have those fruits. Should have those. And make sure we don't have any of these similar qualities that we can let into.